Okay, Mr. Faust.
Yes, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Travis Faust, and I'm here on behalf of my client, Dr. Lathania Joy Baker, in connection with her appeal of the district court's grant of summary judgment in favor of her Equal Pay Act claim, which is based at this stage of the litigation and on the appeal on the inequitable production bonus structure that Appellee Upson Medical Center put into place between her, Dr. Baker, and her male comparator, Dr. Nicholas Somiatis. The district court found that plaintiff in this case had established a prima facie case of her claim of inequitable pay based on the bonus structure. That the record clearly established that Dr. Somiatis had a different bonus compensation structure, and it resulted in more compensation to him, which in turn occurred even though they performed a similar job that required the same skill, effort, and responsibility under the similar circumstances. Now, in reaching its decision, the court really relied on two to possibly three points of evidence in this case. But the important part here is that in an EPA case, unlike a Title VII case, once the employee establishes that prima facie case, then the burden actually shifts. The burden, it's not just a burden of production. The burden shifts to the employer to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the differential is based on one of the four factors listed within the EPA statute.
And it's summary judgment, which this was decided at summary judgment?
Yes, Your Honor.
The test would be, has the employer put forth substantial evidence on the record such that no rational juror could decide the case a different way on that issue? Correct?
That's exactly right, Judge right. Proctor. And if a rational juror could reach a different conclusion, then the case should proceed to trial and allow a jury to make that determination.
I'm going to suggest that we should be laser focused on how does the Equal Pay Act apply at the Rule 56 stage in this case, since we didn't get to trial. And we're not dealing with a trial instruction at this point, a jury instruction.
Right. At this stage, if there's any, and it's the same, the judge
we
is
have
not...
four affirmative defenses.
There are four affirmative defenses.
That an employer can assert.
Yes, Your Honor.
And if the employer asserts one of those defenses and presents substantial evidence that, if believed, would sustain the affirmative defense, and there's no evidence that creates a genuine issue of material fact about that affirmative defense, then the employer does get summary judgment.
But here, Wade, I don't believe the defendant put forth sufficient
evidence. Do
you
agree that's how it works?
I think it's a little bit more in detail than that, Your Honor, because the burden shifts, not just sufficient evidence, but substantial evidence,
to
where a judge makes
defense.
A determination that, no, as Judge Proctor said, no reasonable jury could reach a different conclusion. That's the standard. It's very different than Title VII, where the employer just has the burden of production, and that's
actually
where
it's the burden of articulation.
Articulation,
it's not even production.
Exactly. It's what's the legitimate reason?
In pretext analysis of Title VII, because
and not in EPA.
Bears the burden of showing a prima facie case and pretext.
The burden never shifts from the
so
plaintiff.
So let's say we agree with you that pretext isn't part of this analysis. All right?
Okay.
By the way, the 11th Circuit's not the only circuit, and maybe the EEOC is going to address this, that has pretext or a third step built in. Let's go back to our 1985 decision. I think it was Brock.
Yes, Your Honor.
Only had two steps. Plaintiff establishes a prima facie case. If so, burden shifts to the employer to establish one of the four exceptions under the statute applies, correct?
Correct.
So explain what your opportunity would be when we get to that step. What does the plaintiff get to do? Maybe not, I think we all agree, the plaintiff doesn't have to do anything. But what does the plaintiff have the opportunity to do at that step?
The plaintiff has the opportunity to cite to the evidence in the record as to why there is some doubt as to whether that is a legitimate, justified reason.
District court judge, there is a material issue of fact on their defense here that has to go to a jury.
Exactly right. And here, we can look at what the district court relied on. There were basically, one, there's a lower threshold for Ms. Baker because she's a new employee, and this is just, desirable for new plaintiffs. Well, Again, you can see in our briefs, we disagree as to whether this corporate representative actually articulated that as a true basis, because she was not the decision maker. But even beyond that...
And that's one of the questions I have, quite frankly, is we're not looking at the state of mind of the employer. We're just trying to determine, is there a reasonable factor other than sex that would justify a different pay structure, correct?
I agree, and let's look at
what... It's not a pretext issue where we're looking at the employer's
motive.
Let's
look at the basis for this compensation structure. The basis for this compensation structure is purely production. There's a WRVU that's achieved. That WRVU is the same value regardless of who the doctor who performs the procedure is. It's the same value regardless of how long in experience the doctor has had practicing. One of the things upon which the defendant relied upon saying Dr. Somianis, well, he'd been practicing longer. Well, but they started at the same time.
Your comparator had position. Other responsibilities than just doing the piecework.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe the evidence shows that. It showed the evidence from Ms. Thompson, the representative, is that these people had the same job, hired at the same time with the same title. There was no hierarchy raising one above the other.
No mentorship?
No. They said they expected that perhaps there would be a mentorship, but she never reported to him. He didn't direct her work. Well,
there's a difference between mentoring and reporting.
There is, and I think there's a difference between the a formal...
What about the fact that he had 15 years of practice and they could put in their literature to others, we have two doctors, one has 15 years experience, one has 2 or 3 years experience.
And Your Honor, I think that comes into play in the base salary, which is a component once we got to discover we've dropped from the case. But when the bonus is based purely on production and the parties have the same level of production, or one has more and receives less compensation, when that level of production for both dictates, no matter who does it, the same financial benefit to the hospital, how can that justify a differential pay plan?
Your position that the pretext third step that you claim was error affected the calculus at the Rule 56 stage, and the district court made some error because it incorrectly applied our precedent.
I think it's twofold, Your Honor. I think first, I don't believe there was enough sufficient evidence produced to satisfy the burden of persuasion of the preponderance of the evidence that's required by the law. And second, I think the judge used the pretext analysis to conflate what, as you said, a burden of articulation. There's no need to go to a pretext analysis if it's a burden of production or a burden of persuasion of preponderance of the evidence.
What's your best case scenario here? Would it be a remand back with a clarification
back
as the rule and reassess summary judgment in light of this?
I think the case could be reversed entirely as it comes with respect to the bonus compensation based on the WRVU production, which is purely a mathematical formula.
A general rule, I'm the one who gets paid when I'm sitting at a different court to assess summary judgment on the front end. So that's why I'm asking the question.
Yes, sir.
It seems like your best case scenario would be we would remand the case back to the district court, say, under Brock, this is our standard. We're going to clarify what our case law has been and how it should be read, and reassess summary judgment based upon that standard.
I believe that it would be more of that you could also reverse it because they applied the wrong standard, but that is also an outcome. Yes, Your Honor. I think.
Thank you,
Mr. Faust. You've saved 2 minutes, Ms. Patel.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Tara Patel for the EEOC. I want to go back to underscore the correct legal standard in this case. We asked this court to correct a discrete legal error. The district court added a step that doesn't exist to an established Equal Pay Act analysis. It shifted the burden back to the plaintiff to prove that defendant's affirmative defense was pretextual, thereby injecting a discriminatory intent requirement that this court has repeatedly rejected.
But you would agree with what I outlined for Mr. Faust, would you not, that if the employer puts forth evidence, substantial evidence, to support an affirmative defense. And depending on what the plaintiff has either already presented or presents about that affirmative defense, if then on the state of the record there's no genuine issue of material fact about the affirmative defense, the employer can get summary judgment in that scenario, right?
Yes, Your Honor. We want to underscore again that the standard at the summary judgment stage is that does the record show that the defendant established the defense so clearly that no rational jury could have found to the contrary? And if that's the case, then in that case, the plaintiff would lose. Mm-hmm. So both.
And if that's the case, then it doesn't matter whether the court articulated a third step because you wouldn't get to it. Do you agree with that?
Your Honor, respectfully, I think in this case, we don't know what the court would have done in the first instance if it didn't have that third step in the back of its mind.
Well, how about this? It's a summary judgment record that we reviewed de novo. It wouldn't matter what the court thought. We could decide it ourselves.
Yes, Your Honor, this court could decide it yourselves. We would argue that it would be great for an opportunity for the district court to have the opportunity to apply the correct standard.
It potentially would be a waste of time.
Potentially, Your Honor. So what this court and the Supreme Court have...
Now, I know you're a friend of the court here, and I suspect you have some friendship with the plaintiff. So what is the material issue of fact that the jury should decide? Is it what Mr. Faust said, that these arguments about the distinction... The reasonable factor other than sex go to base pay, not bonus pay?
Yes, Your Honor, and plaintiff's counsel can correct me if I'm wrong, but the question here is has the plaintiff raised a genuine dispute of fact as to whether there's a problem with the base pay?
The record shows that the plaintiff was hired first, had a lawyer that negotiated her bonus structure, then a more senior doctor was come in. There was a negotiation about his bonus structure that obviously was more favorable than what she had had to start. And that after that she became aware of that, her lawyer came back in and renegotiated her bonus structure to be consistent with the more senior doctors, correct?
Yes, that record does.
All right,
state
so
that.
What about that indicates that there was any... that the bonus structure given to him was not a reasonable factor other than sex?
Well, again, I would defer this to plaintiff's counsel, this question of fact, but I believe that the problem with the bonus pay was that both doctors were generating for the hospital the same amount of money for their service or activity, but were receiving different amounts of pay, even though they were doing the same thing and generating for the hospital that same amount of money.
Make sure I've got something clear. The commission really doesn't take a position on whether summary judgment ultimately should be granted to the defendant or not. Your concern is that our case law be made clear about how this framework works. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Our chief concern is correcting this discrete legal error, and the commission doesn't take an ultimate position on which way these facts bear out. So in conclusion, to make correct...
With me, we don't have to go en banc to clarify how the standard works. That if you look at case law of ours that maybe has some unfortunate language, but you actually consider what the holding was.
That's right, Your Honor.
And the context, maybe trial as opposed to summary judgment, our case law can be reconciled and made and explained correctly, can it not?
That's right. And I see my time is up. May I answer the question?
You may.
Thank you. Yes, under this court's prior precedent rule, this court has articulated the correct standard in a series of cases. Mitchell, one of the oldest controlling precedents on this point, as well as Miranda and Meeks. So this would be unnecessary to go en banc. This court can correct this discrete legal error by referring to those precedential opinions.
Any questions? Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank
Patel.
You, Your Honor.
Mr. Luskin.
May it please the court, Your Honors. I'm Robert Luskin, and I have the pleasure of representing Upson Regional Medical Center in this matter. The lower court, as we've already addressed, has addressed granted summary judgment in favor of Upson on two issues that were presented related to the Equal Pay Act as well as the Title VII claim. Title VII claim, we would argue, was essentially abandoned in the underlying action. There was a timeliness issue. It was not addressed by the, and it wasn't addressed here for Your Honors as well. Upson Regional Medical Center, and we would agree that the Equal Pay Act, the first have to be a prima facie case. That wasn't anything that was really addressed in the lower court. It's not something we're addressing before this court here today. We presented a legitimate and met the fourth standard, the fourth burden under the case law, as well
affirmative
as
affirmative defense, right?
An affirmative defense, number four, for something other than sex. We stated that, certainly it was presented earlier, that you're not just looking at salary, you're also looking at this bonus structure. That's really what they're arguing about.
You'd agree that this mention of pretext in an Equal Pay Act analysis is off the mark?
I would agree that this court, even as recently as 2020, dealt with this issue in the Reddy case, and then in which had been cited by Burnett in the Middle District of Georgia, where this case arose out of, and it even had gone back to several other cases, that there is a split. Not every circuit does agree that pretext does not apply, but I would agree that at the end of the day, it is irrelevant and doesn't matter if the lower court, from the standpoint of
pretext... Well, let's say it matters to us.
Sure.
It really doesn't have a place in the analysis for an Equal Pay Act claim, does it?
It does not, based upon, we would contend that, we would agree that at this point it would not. So we then get to a general summary judgment standard. Was there evidence presented?
Is there a genuine issue of material fact about your affirmative defense?
There is not. We would contend there is not the...
question, though, right?
Yes, Your Honor. It is. That is the question you go back to at that point.
What do you say to their position that all his experience, his safe deliveries... all had to do with what his initial pay rate was in terms of base salary? They abandoned that because they realized you had a reasonable factor other than sex to justify the base salary. But those factors can't be reasonable as it relates to calculation of bonuses because they're based upon the same revenue being paid to the hospital for each one of these components of work.
So I would disagree with their assertion, and I can tell you why. And we actually stated this in not only in our brief, but it was stated by our corporate representative, which is you have to look at experience. That's a relevant factor. The cases have all said that you can look at experience. Dr. Somiatis had 15 years of experience, was board certified, which is an important thing in the medical context, while Dr. Baker was not, had approximately 2 years of experience.
Well, but let's say we agree with you that it is appropriate to take experience into account for the tiered bonus system. But you also have to show that the factor of sex provided no basis for the wage differential and that none of the decision makers, whether in middle or upper management, were influenced by sex bias with respect to the actual dollar amounts. And here, your 30B6 deponent testified that she didn't know how the specific dollar amounts were reached. Why is there not a genuine issue of material fact there?
So, Your Honor, I would say that if you actually look at the record and you actually look at the testimony, that excerpt that Your Honor just mentioned was actually cherry-picked, and specifically, and the district court actually took a great length of approximately 2 pages to actually outline the specific language. She does not say, as it was quoted in the brief, that I don't recall the specifics of the conversation. In their brief on page 12, they say, I don't recall the specifics of the conversation. I don't know exactly, dot, dot, dot. I don't know how the number came up. You actually can look to the on page 19 and page 20 of the district court. Judge Self actually took the actual snapshot of the testimony, and it specifically says, when they were discussing the conversation from our corporate representative, I don't recall the specific words of the conversation. But it was That's how we did it from the, that's how we established the rates of pay. That's what we looked at in order to hire the physician. And then it goes down further. What they have done is, what the what plaintiff has done is they've taken two very lengthy sentences and combined them. We actually say, I don't, she actually says, I do not know exactly. I'm just a conversation, but I recall from the many years ago, because this was 5 years later, I know that we talked about that. I don't know how that number came about, so she doesn't know the specifics of the number, but I know we talked about his years of experience, and he talked about his track record being so good. And he, she also went on to say earlier, in a earlier, that the specific reason that the threshold, which is what we're talking about here, at the point at which she begins to bonus, is much lower, and the specific reason was she was less experienced. There was no track record. She'd only been practicing as a doctor for approximately two and a half years at most. And it allowed her, as is quoted in her deposition and the testimony, and it's the only thing in the record, mind you, on page 47, that it gave her the ability to ramp up in her practice.
Yeah, and in essence, it was this is basically a no deed, good deed goes unpunished scenario, because what they were doing was giving her an opportunity to ramp up her practice and earn that additional compensation, actually, at lower thresholds.
That's correct, Your Honor. And I think it is important to note that this was an arm's length negotiated transaction. This was not a take it or leave it proposition that Upson came to Dr. Baker and said, here's your contract, sign it or go down the street to Columbus. Mm-hmm. She had not only an attorney representing her, she had someone that she has described, and it's in the record, as a contract specialist who deals exclusively with medical doctors.
Okay, but you would agree with me that in her testimony, she just says, based on a conversation, we took into account experience when we established the rates of pay. Is there any detailed discussion of why the rate was this dollar amount for hers?
Why the specific, the RVU rate was?
Yes.
No, there's no specific recognition as to what the dollar amounts were. The question there was the question of the threshold. When you started, when she actually started bonusing, there the salaries were different as we discussed earlier.
So the argument is she had a lower threshold for achieving a bonus, and so therefore the dollar amount may have been lower at the upper end.
You think about
and that differential, all of that, that entire tiered differential is related to experience, to give her the opportunity to ramp it up.
Exactly. And it was negotiated. And if you look back, I know it's not this, the 11th Circuit hasn't dealt with this, but when we look at issues other than sex or a reason other than sex, one of those reasons can be a negotiated arm's length transaction. And if you look, and if Your Honor's cited in our briefs, but the 5th Circuit and the 6th Circuit have both dealt with this issue and have held that, yes, you can look at arm's length transactions. You can have difference of opinions. For example, in the Sixth Circuit, in the case that we cited in our brief, and it is mentioned, the Schleicher case, there was someone essentially bet on themselves. They said, I'd rather take, in a negotiated transaction, more on the bonus and less on the pay. And I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to get that bonus. And then someone else was on a lower pay, but took the salary and less of the bonus, and ultimately they made them equitable, and that's what brought the case about. And so the Sixth Circuit and the Fifth Circuit, in the Resnick case, which actually deals with a medical practice, dealt with this issue, and that is certainly, we believe, while not binding on this court, would certainly be illustrative as to yet another reason why something other than sex was the basis for their decision to put Dr. Baker on a different bonus structure with a lower threshold. Finally, on the Title VII matter, we believe that it was certainly waived. The timeliness issue, there is not a question there.
No, that wasn't contested and on appeal, the timeliness issue, right?
And that's we would get in that they was certainly waived. You know, from the standpoint
abandoned is the way I would look at it, forfeited.
From the standpoint of whether we as Upson have met our burden, we do not believe there is a question of fact left for our jury to decide. We've stated our reason. That reason is unrebutted. The only rebuttal Judge Proctor, I think even asked the question earlier. It's like, what are you, you know, or may have been you, Judge Pryor, as well. Okay, assuming we do not have pretext.
One thing's for sure. It was either Judge Proctor or a Judge Pryor.
That is true. That is true. That even if we don't go to pretext, what do we look at the other part? Okay, the burden doesn't shift, but they have to do. They may have to do something. They should have to say something, and there's nothing. The record is devoid of anything. However, we do have Dr. Baker's testimony, which we had cited to, that specifically says, no one ever told me.
I've couched that in terms of an opportunity, not an obligation.
I would agree.
If there's a material issue of fact in the record, it doesn't matter if a party raises it. If the court identifies it, it's a material issue of fact.
I would agree that they do not, from that standpoint, they don't have to, but it would certainly be, there still has to be an attack of some sort to show, or some explanation to show why the stated reason and why there is a material
fact.
That
is the best practice, isn't it?
Practice is something what the court wanted to see, and it's something that the court specifically outlined in their brief, in their order. And so for those reasons, Your Honors, we'd ask that the summary judgment, that the lower court's decision be affirmed. Thank you very much.
Luskin, Mr. Faust, you've saved 2 minutes.
Let me get you started.
Yes, Your Honor.
Did your client herself say she liked, this is on the 2018 amendment, she liked the RV use system, would not do quite as many RVUs as the comparator because of patient differences, and she would prefer to leave her bonus structure tiered?
That statement's taken from an email, which no testimony was required from my client during her deposition. I will say, if you go through that email too, she says, okay, tiered would work, but I want something to level the playing field. So she clearly, when she learned of the disparity between the pay, she immediately began trying to address it. She lays out, maybe tiered this way, but it's but that's not what happened. What happened in this case, and what their designee testified to, is once she finally raised the issue, they gave her the same contract language as Dr. Somiatis. And the reason their designee said they get it was because it was fair. That's her testimony. It's on page 101 of her deposition. It was fair for them to equalize the bonus structure between the two of them because they're doing the same job and they started at the same time. Now, as far as the cases, the arm's length transaction has to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. Every female who accepts lower paying wages accepts them. That has to be done. Here there was an attorney. We don't know what was the transaction was with that attorney, but Ms. Baker testified that she didn't push back because she assumed on this component of her compensation she'd be treated equitably. And the minute she found out, she started raising it. So the concept that a young lawyer might want this to ramp up their practice doesn't hold water. And I want to briefly, very quickly, just discuss the issue about the lower threshold. Dr. Somiatis' contract was broken over two halves of the year. If both of the doctors had billed 4,500 or 4,400 WRVUs in the first half, Dr. Somiatis would have gotten $40 per RVU over 39,000 or 3,990, and my client would have gotten zero.
Okay, we understand your argument, Mr. Faust, and we'll be in recess until tomorrow.
Thank you.